There are lots of changes coming up for Great Women in Fraud. A big thank you to our community and specifically Carice Hendrick for making an introduction and giving me the push to go bigger for our community. What does that mean exactly? Well, a new title is forthcoming. Because our Great Women in Fraud is also Great Dudes in Fraud, but you all know SEO, and changing the title will help with others finding this amazing podcast with all new wonderful guests. The new name is Fraudish. Kind of like Blackish? Murderish? Please let me know what you think, but also please be kind. What a better way to start this off is with Jen Hoare, who is a human expert. I love her quote, "I want to go back to something," and quote, "Those who balk the most talk the most." Let's get started. It's a great episode, and I love how she turns the questions back to me at points. Clever. We are two sisters from two different mothers. Let's go. Okay, Great Women in Fraud, we have a great woman in Humint. So we have with us Jen Hoare, and she is based in DC. But what I love about Jen is I think initially I connected with you on LinkedIn, and then you're like, "I love this Great Women in Fraud. I'd like to be on it." And so here we are. And so thank you for reaching out, because guys, this is how the community grows. So Jen, I'm going to ask you a few word associations, and then you can give your sort of elevator speech. Okay.
That sounds fun. And I want to point out that I practiced what I preach of human intelligence in the way that we met, because I liked your background and I thought, I got to meet her and I want to talk to her. So I'm just going to introduce myself. And here we are. So thank you for finishing the circuit of that process so we could be here today.
Yeah, it's awesome. It is awesome. And we have lots of sort of, I don't know, our lives are kind of like this. So it's okay, Jen, when you think of fraud, what comes to mind? The word fraud.
Just free association, naughty.
Yep. Naughty.
Malfeasance.
Oh, I like that. Naughty and malfeasance. Okay, how about ethics?
Virtuous.
Ooh, like that. Okay. And who makes better embezzlers, men or women?
That's a good one. I know you ask a lot of guests this. I'm going to say women, because they can be very disarming and run interference in a way that can distract from the wrongdoing.
Yeah, I agree. Which goes to human intelligence. So why don't you give your sort of elevator or Eiffel Tower speech, and then we can get to the human.
That sounds very elegant. Well, I identify as a recovering journalist. I will always be recovering, and I'm happy to be, because I had been a reporter in the media for about 5.5 years. It was the first thing I did in my career. Very much loved it. Found that it engages a lot of parts of my personality as well as my intellectual interests in a social way, and attracts other people of like mind and personality and temperament. And I found it to be a very engaging profession. And I'm lucky to have discovered this industry that we're in now of corporate intelligence and investigations, because I feel that I can apply a lot of that same tradecraft and a lot of the all of the benefits of curiosity in my work every day. And I basically get to talk to people and learn from them, just like I did as a journalist, but for a very different audience, and often for very sophisticated consumers of information. And that's very rewarding.
Cool. Very, very cool. So I want to ask you right off the bat, do you have a favorite question when you're interviewing someone or questioning them?
I'm glad you're making me think about this. And I saw your questions that you like to ask your guests, and I voraciously consumed them and got some ideas for myself, by the way, because it's both very conversational as well as very purposeful and directed, and in some cases, very specific. But to answer your question, my answer will be unsatisfying, which is I really like to say to somebody, and this is true personally, tell me about dot, dot, dot. So that's not an interrogative in a formal sense, but it opens up conversation and it allows the interlocutor in whatever context it's in to say whatever they're thinking about. And that is the beauty of stimulating a really fruitful conversation, is leaving it to the other person to decide what they want to say. But I suppose if I had to pick a specific question that is relevant to my work that I find to be beneficial and it gets conversation going, is what do you like about your work? Or what do you think you would want to do if you didn't work in your current job, or what you identify as your area of expertise and specialization. And that's a good way of getting a foothold into what somebody does in their job without saying, what's your job? What's your title? In a really boring, formulaic way.
Yeah, which I kind of think is so American.
It is. Yes. And I think I'm on a little bit of a campaign to encourage people to be more creative in how they ask each other about their work. There's nothing, especially if you love your work, as I do, and you do, there's nothing wrong with talking about your work or your role, but I think there are more interesting ways to navigate into talking about it that really helps us to learn about each other, not just what we do at our jobs.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, if I say at an event and I say that I'm a certified fraud examiner, they are like, fraud? But then if I add on the private investigator, ears perk up.
Right.
And I think, did I send you Michael Lewis's L6, six levels down about Gladys?
You didn't.
Okay. Well, I will put that in the show notes. I put it in the show notes all the time. But it's about a woman who works in a basement of, say, a medical billing facility. And we underestimate that person. And if you went to, say, an event, or just say you had to interview her, and you said, what do you do? And she's like, well, I'm a billing clerk. Now, that tells you nothing.
Right.
You say, what do you like to do? In this podcast episode with Michael Lewis, it's, I like to get the most amount of money for my doctors in the best way due to the knowledge I have of so many years of experience. But if she just goes, I work for Dr. Smith, and I don't. Right. That's so boring. Right. And she's
not
genius.
At all.
Yeah.
And
she's
that's genius. Is someone who describes it in a latter way, the way Michael Lewis described it, is someone who takes pride in his or her job and the work and the vocation of it and the profession. And that's a big distinguishing factor. I also think that talking to somebody about not what, as I said before, their title is or the name of their employer, but what do they work on that they enjoy? I think that's a really useful way to extract what is at the heart of what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're a human intelligence expert and you talk to people all day long. What are some myths that you want to debunk about source work?
Thank you for teeing that up. The main myth I want to debunk is I am myself and my purpose at all times. There is no subterfuge or obfuscation that goes on. It is so important to learn from people on a completely transparent, forthright basis. That creates certainly a predicate for trust and rapport, but also that's the only way to be effective. That's the only way to be ethical in doing this work. And that's why I bring it back to the recovering journalist identity, because while when I was a journalist, and let's say when I worked at CBS News and I would call someone, I would say, I'm Jen Hoare, I work for CBS News. It was straightforward what I did. In the context now with my wonderful employer, Forward Risk and Intelligence, I always share with whom I work, where I work, and explain what it is that we do and what I do for a living and how I got to what I do now and why I'm calling and why I found them. And I think that maybe due to the fallacies of TV and movies about this kind of work, there's this false belief that you need to hide and not completely share details. And it's completely the other way around. That's true in all kinds of personal interactions, as well as professional interactions. The more you share, the more you can establish what you're trying to accomplish together in a conversation. And that's super important to me.
Well, and I remember I've done over 1,000 background investigations. I love meeting people. And I'm going to go with a pregnant pause. What do you think about the pregnant pause?
Can't say enough good things about it. In fact, in a training I've developed about how to do this work, as well as how to apply the tradecraft of human intelligence work to all professional contexts, like sales, business development, entrepreneurship, I talk about how important it is to let silence sit. Because one, it's important to give people space to think and to listen. I mean, I think that's just sometimes an etiquette thing. But in the technique or the work of doing this and interviewing somebody, it also, I find that people fill that space. And going back to what I said earlier about the open-ended nature of conversation and giving people an opportunity to share what's come up for them, I think that those pauses are really important to allowing them to fill it with what came up for them. Another, as an adjacent thought, something that's really important that I learned as a journalist is asking at the end of every conversation, maybe not with your friend at a bar, but what else have I not asked that I should ask, as well as who else should I talk to? But going back to the first one, it's always fascinating to me. People often reflexively answer, oh, nothing more, but then they start talking again. And I think that speaks to the fact that it's just giving them the space to explore in their own mind what else might they want to add, just because you say, well, what else am I missing?
That's so funny. So Warren Berger, the questionologist, calls that the awe question, and what else? And I use it all the time when I was doing background investigations for Office of Personnel Management. I would always end it. And I was like, what haven't I asked you? Or what do you want to tell me? And I just love it. And just did the pregnant pause. And you'd be amazed what, well, there was this one time. And it was so funny because I used to ask this question. I did them in Wisconsin. And there was a lot of underage drinking for security clearances for going into the military. And I used to ask this question like, so is there anything you want to tell me? Like Johnny or Sally showed up and parked their car on your lawn one night, something like that. And I said it one time to a neighbor of mine who asked me what I did. And I said, I go around and I ask questions, and they were really fascinated. And I throw up this, there's a lot of underage drinking. And I say, has Johnny landed in your driveway? And she goes, the woman goes, oh my God, you don't know about my husband. He's a recovering alcoholic. And he honestly used to do that all the time. And I was horrified.
Oh my gosh.
It was so funny. It was just like, she gave me this look like, you must know. And I didn't know, because it was pretty funny. But yeah, I had another interaction. I would like your opinion on this. I was told that I asked an inappropriate question. And the inappropriate question was, there are three people on a boat and there are only two life jackets. Who gets the life jackets? And my boss is like, that's inappropriate. However, he didn't hear the front part of it. The woman had told me that her therapist said, you need to visualize. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to visualize. I don't know. What do you think about that? I didn't think it was a terrible question at all.
To whom did you ask that question?
It was just an employee. And so I wanted to know her opinion of the three people. And I said, who would you give the two life jackets to? So basically the one person that you don't trust. And he goes, that's
right.
And I'm like, it's not.
I can understand how the framing could be off-putting because it's kind of binary. But fundamentally, and you just said it, what you were getting at was you wanted to learn about this other person's assessment of who they trusted and didn't trust. And that is a very interesting question to explore. I can understand the sensibilities of people about how things are framed. And I'm always thinking of what's the best way to ask something in order to get at what it is that I'm trying to learn. But at the same time, I kind of like your creativity of how you got at it. I think that's so important in, well, first of all, being yourself, but second of all, talking to people in your style and in your words. I wanted to add to something we said before, which is I find it fascinating how, and this is important in all kinds of settings when you're interviewing people in a formal sense or an informal sense, trying to learn from them by asking questions. I have this saying that those who balk the most talk the most, which is especially in some of the work that I do, understandably people, they don't know me and they aren't expecting to hear from me. And they're not totally sure what is this context that this woman is calling me about. And they're trying to get a handle on what this phone call is and who I am and what I'm doing. And I firmly believe, and I teach this to my colleagues, that you have to affirm people's discomfort and fill in gaps of what may they need to know to assuage their concern to participate. And I often find that people who ask the most questions up front, what is this? Who are you calling about? What is this for? They should do that. I would do the same thing. But those often end up being the people that are the most talkative. But of course, that is possible because you're addressing their concerns of what it is that you're calling about. And I think that's an important thing for all of us to know. You could go into a meeting with a prospective investor or a client or a partner or a new colleague. And if they're balking, that can be good because that means they care and they want to learn. And it's important to be able to equip them with all of the information they need to decide about whether or not they want to participate in talking with you.
So this is another question for you about when you catch someone lying, what do you do?
Well, it's not always that overt. I think it starts in small indicators of, I'm not getting the whole picture here. There are inconsistencies. That is one of the, I'm not the first person to say this, obviously, but the inconsistencies or even contradictions in information shared, the first thing I do is I say, I want to go back to something. I want to make sure I understand something. Accusation does not work. Nobody wants to be put on the spot about anything. But usually the first indicators are something isn't making sense here. So I want to revisit, first of all, check my understanding of it, but second of all, and give them that person an opportunity to clarify, because I don't want to immediately assume deception. But I think it starts with going back to information and saying, something does not square for me. And something you just said, help me, going back to your question from earlier, another technique or question I like to ask is, help me understand X, Y, or Z. That's the first thing that I do. I don't purport to be an expert on detection, deception, or specific biophysical tells of lying, but I do pay attention very closely to what I'm hearing and what I'm being told and how that comports or doesn't comport with what I think should be happening.
Yeah. So this year, well, about a year and a half ago, maybe, I do a lot of trainings with fraud and pop culture. So, and I know we had talked about the jinx, about Robert Durst, but do you have, and I'm thinking of, oh my gosh, it's the tobacco whistleblower story. I'm totally spacing with Russell Crowe and Al Pacino. Do you have any movies or shows that you sit there and go, oh, that was a great question, or, oh, they should not have done that? Do you critique like I critique?
Oh, for sure. I think I critique more some of these true crime documentaries, which I've consumed throughout the pandemic. And friends, not that I'm the consummate expert, but friends who were watching those shows recreationally would say, oh, what do you think about this? And I remember picking apart some episodes of the Netflix reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, which I used to watch as a kid in the 90s, and I really enjoy it. Of course, they're unsolved, but the way that the documentary or that Netflix treated the cases, I thought, well, wait, you're missing a question there. Or what, didn't you look into this or that? That's one off the top of my head. As a fun aside, when you brought up pop culture, my ears perked up because I consider myself the pop culture vulture. I occupy a lot of ridiculous space in my brain for dumb pop culture knowledge. A lot of times people say to me, oh, your work reminds me of, have you ever seen Veronica Mars? I'm usually, no, I haven't. The other one is some character from The Good Wife, which I also haven't seen. I guess I need to watch more network TV. So I should probably look into those things and see how accurately they depict any component of my job. But going back to your question, I really do like some of these documentaries. When we talked last week, I brought up The Jinx because I thought that the investigative work that they did before they sat down with Robert Durst so that they could present him with really interesting information and ask really good questions in amazingly unconfrontational ways so that they could potentially elicit useful information. I thought that was really masterful. And I talked to someone who I think knew one of the researchers or directors on that series. And I think they had done something like 10 years of research before they actually did that documentary. And that to me is the real meat of this work, is you have to do a lot of research before you're asking good questions, especially on an HBO documentary series with a three-time alleged murderer. You know, you've got to be really prepared for something like that. So I thought that was a pretty good example. What about you? What do you get frustrated with when you watch some of these pop culture representations of work that you do?
Everyone, because of the pop culture, everyone thinks that things are solved so quickly. And again, 10 years for Robert Durst, and there's never going to be a CSI embezzlement 1 hour episode because the cases just aren't that way. When I'm watching some of them, I'm kind of like, I don't want to say that was a stupid question, but it's kind of like, oh, that was a leading question. Like, let's not,
right.
The leading questions, and everyone who listens to the podcast knows that sometimes I have issues with attorneys investigating because, I mean, I worked a big case with an attorney and like his interviews were so quick, and I don't want to say quick and dirty, but like, I was like, slow down, you know, we need to slow down because First off, you show up in a black zoot suit and you're intimidating. I don't want to be intimidating.
That's right.
Yeah.
I had worked at a firm for a wonderful mentor, rest in peace, Terry Lenzner of Investigative Group International. And he's a trained attorney and had a lot of wonderful skills from that. And he used to comment to me when he hired me, and a lot of it was for my interview expertise. And he would say to me, and he insisted on calling me Jennifer, not Jen. And he said, Jennifer, you're very disarming. And that's a huge help here. But I also saw that the open-ended nature of the way I asked questions and you asked questions was really, really important, not just because of the way that it opens up the source to share whatever he or she wants to share, but because that's just the way that I think. That's the way that I approach talking to somebody. It's not to say that an attorney necessarily asks leading questions, but they have a little bit more of an objective in my experience. Wonderful training. Wonderful intellect in a lot of regards, but a different approach to asking questions. I actually have a question for you, which is, and I know I'm turning your podcast back on you, but do you think curiosity is something that is innate, or can it be cultivated, or is it a combination of both? It seems innate in you, but I'm curious what you think about how that can be nurtured in a person.
So my dad called it being Snoopy. And I want to say it's innate, but I also want to say if you pick the right career, you can really grow with it. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's connecting the dots, whether I'm connecting someone to a connection online or something like that, or I see someone and I'm like, that just doesn't make sense. I have this thing, the parking lot audit. You look in the parking lot, and if a $40,000 a year employee shows up in a brand new Range Rover, it doesn't make sense. So it becomes curious. So it's kind of like, I think I am curious because so many things don't make sense to me. And I want to understand why or how. Like, and I've said this before, my group soup at U.S. Customs, he's like, I don't care why they did it. Just put them in jail. And I was like, I want to know why. Like the curiosity of why. You're going along in life and everything is good. And all of a sudden you decide to steal. Why? So I think it's innate, but I also think that you can really, if you are passionate about something, you will become curious about it in whatever it is you do.
That's a great explanation and very encouraging. And I think it sounds like if you care about your work, going back to the pride of purpose in one's vocation, whatever it is that you do, you don't have to actually be an investigator by profession to be curious or to cultivate curiosity. You have to care about your work and doing it better. And in some ways, challenging norms and status quo and wanting to do things differently. And this relates a little bit to human intelligence work. I think that there's an intersection of human intelligence work and negotiation. If you really want to understand, and I don't mean necessarily negotiation in a strict job salary negotiation context, but it could be saying, why is something done this way? I want to understand why this is the case. And we were just talking about how you got a first class upgrade, going up and saying to the at the desk at the airport, just curious, is there a complimentary upgrade available for me today? That desire to ask that question springs from the same well as asking a source, tell me about your job and what went well at it and what didn't go as well. It's kind of taking that leap of I could be complacent and not knowing, or I could just try and see what happens and see what this person tells me. And in the first class upgrade situation, maybe that will ultimately benefit you. Maybe it won't, but there's no harm in asking. And the same thing with a source. I could ask them a question they don't want to answer, but what's the worst that could happen? They could say, I don't want to answer. Well, then you move on. But if you don't take that step and you don't kind of jump out of or take yourself out of potential complacency or plateauing, you'll never know what you could have learned or what benefit you could have gained in terms of a more comfortable seat and a free drink.
And my daughter walking past me and glaring at me as she goes back to the lemon class. Oh my God. So what do you say to the audience out there about how to get into more human intelligence?
Well, there are two ways. If you're in a context where you work in law or private equity or venture capital, which is a big cause of mine right now, and you want to learn more about those with whom you are planning to partner or invest or work, and you want to explore using human intelligence work or AKA interviewing to learn more about potential partners and clients, investors, et cetera. I would love to explore the opportunity to work together. Shameless plug for my firm, Forward Risk and Intelligence in Washington, D.C. But also, I think that there is a lot of application to engaging, question asking more in your daily life, in your profession, in your personal life, to not only learn more of a potential client or in a business context, but also to learn more about your colleagues and what's going on in your organization. I used to work at a very large tech company that you can figure out if you look on my LinkedIn. And I used to encourage colleagues of mine to meet people in other teams and see what they're working on, especially if it was relevant to or directly overlapping with what we were working on. There's so much you can learn from the people that are sitting right next to you, both to get more close with them and to learn more about who they are as colleagues, but also maybe it could benefit your work. And I think that, not that it's a massive paradigm shift, but I think a lot of people lead with talking about what they do or their organization or themselves, and there is a time and place for that. But I think you can get a lot more at times out of asking an interlocutor about what is it that they're working on? What do they care about? What are their pain points and challenges in their work? And that can really unlock a great relationship in any context.
Okay, we're kind of approaching the end, and this question just hit me. Well, I had a boss who wanted to put together a conference at one point, and she's like, I want to tap into all your sources. How do you get them? I'm like, by being nice, shuffer. But it led me to the think of what happens, Jen, when you have a gut feeling about something and you're in the midst of, say, an interview, and you get this either really good or really bad gut feeling. How do you tap into that?
Do you mean a gut feeling about what the person's saying, apropos of what we talked about earlier, that something's not adding up? Or you mean a gut feeling about that person and their credibility?
The person and their credibility. Let's do that one.
Well, that would be pretty subjective. But yes, I have learned to trust my very good intuition. It's certainly continue the conversation. What I do is probably go into a degree of overdrive of trying to interrogate my own feelings and my own gut by asking as many questions as possible to learn as much as possible from that person. Because what I'm trying to do is take something highly subjective, like my intuition, although it's often right, and take information that they're telling me that I can bite into in some way and take this corpus of knowledge that I will develop from the questions that I've asked and sort of cross-reference those. So I think I would probably just go more in depth and try to talk to them as much as possible and learn as much as I possibly can. And also then go and cross-reference that information with whatever else I can cross-reference, whether that's in open source or with other human sources. I might not do it right in the moment. I tend to find that the interrogating of my intuitions and gut feelings comes after the interaction.
Okay.
What about you? What do you do?
I hold on to it. I have one example where I had someone I knew and there was something off. I just knew there was something off. And so normally I would have tried to fix things, but I just felt it was off. And in the end, it was off.
How did you end up validating that? How did you confirm? Was it through investigative methods or was it just time playing out and you saw that
time your intuition out.
Got it?
Yeah.
And yeah, that tends to be why I say I do trust my gut and I pay attention to what it's telling me, but I need more information subsequently in order to feel confirmed in it. And it sounds like you have the same experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Danny Kahneman, System 1 and System 2, sleeping.
Right.
We're just slowly gathering evidence to kind of validate my gut.
Right. Right. And that brings me to one more question for you. And I'm sorry, I'm going into interviewer mode on your podcast. What literature, and it doesn't have to be books, but what are your regular, let's say, periodicals that you read to keep abreast of not necessarily our industry, but just kind of all of the relevant disciplines that help to hone the innate and cultivated talents of Kelly?
Oh, I feel like this is a Sarah Palin question. With magazines.
All of them, right?
Yeah, all of them. One is Scientific American, which my husband would get. And I like, there was always something in it that was really good. Dan Ariely posts stuff in it. Francesca Gino. Wired. I really like Wired. Mm-hmm. I consume so much online. I'm really into the behavioral economics, behavioral science. So anything, a lot of Harvard Business Review. I just love content and podcasts. I take over 20,000 steps a day and I'm always listening to a podcast. Always.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad I asked that because you gave me a couple of ideas. We definitely share Harvard Business Review. I'm pleased to report I have a hard copy here.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. I asked that because I think it's so interesting to learn from fellow investigators about what adjacent literature do you read? I mean, there's not an investigations monthly that we all read necessarily, but even if there were and you did read that, I think I gained so many ideas and so much context about the client world and related disciplines from some of the publications you described, like A Fast Company, yep. Love Wired, Love Harvard Business Review. I've gotten ideas for maybe approaches for potential clients or industries where investigative services could be really valuable that are untapped from profiles in the New Yorker. I get necessarily business ideas from fiction, but I also, as a former English major, I also think it's important to read fiction. So I loved hearing about what other people whose intellects I trust, like yours, what they're reading outside of our typical stuff. So thank you for the ideas.
The one thing I didn't say was Twitter. I am a
I'm not on that. Oh boy.
So many good sources. People are like, oh, it's just garbage. Okay, Elon. But Twitter, so many sources and people are so giving, and it's the community you curate that leads me to places off of Twitter. So that's
fascinating. Okay.
Yeah.
I should know that, but I'm trying to avoid too many distractions.
Well, and I had a case where someone wanted to do some due diligence and they had a limited budget. And I said, I'm going to go to Twitter. And they're like, Twitter? And they kind of mocked it. And I said, it's real time. And the way people use Twitter, I think there's a lot of personal and professional that combine. Like in my example, I will like things that are maybe medically related to something or, but then professionally. So I really think the liking, the retweeting shows a lot about a person that you can get relatively quickly. So
there's additional context about the content.
Yeah. Yeah.
Based on how people are interacting with it. Yeah. I should know that based on the tech company where I work. Anyway.
Okay. My last question is for you. Okay. Two questions. Okay. What tabs are open on your computer?
Email, schedule, LinkedIn, Harvard Business Review.
Ooh, okay.
And Zoom with you.
Okay. That's not obscene. An obscene amount. I think I have like 20. And then finally, and what else? What else haven't I asked you, or what else do you want to tell the Great Women in Fraud audience?
Wow. So I'm going to do what my sources do. Oh, nothing else to say. And then of course I'm going to think of something. Well, I'm going to say something a little bit on the personal side. As you know, I just lost my dad and he was very, very influential to me in so many ways. But what I think others might underestimate, or I may have underestimated, is how formative he was in shaping how good I am at my job and how much I enjoy it. Specifically on the curiosity front, because when I was a kid, he talked to everybody. And I thought, what is he doing? Why are we talking to this person and held up? Why is he asking this person where they're from? Like, we're just, you know, buying something. What's the point of this? Of course, I'm my father's daughter. I do exactly that in my personal life. But that was an essential ingredient to the work that I do, because I do think I have some innate curiosity, but I also think that that was modeled for me, that you take an interest in other people. And I find people really fascinating. I think it's an amazing and very efficient way to learn about topics and the world in general. And if I leave the audience with anything, it's find opportunities in your life to learn from somebody that you may see all the time or even are just running into that you could ask a question. How's their day going? What are they doing with their day off? How's business going? Asking the Uber driver, how's business these days? How are gas prices affecting you? Maybe that's not up your alley, but finding opportunities in your day to learn from people that you cross paths is very enriching to your life, but also if you do want to chip away at some of the scariness of talking to strangers, if you want to cultivate that more in your work life, start there and you'll be pleasantly surprised how enjoyable and beneficial that is to yourself and your development.
Do you know Nicholas Epley of University of Chicago? Oh, check him out. I'll put him in the show notes. He has something just recent and I'm not going to get it perfectly right, but basically what you just said, ask someone, it actually enriches your life.
It does.
So, yeah. They've shown that it is like, it is actually enriching, statistically shown. So I will try and find the article and put it in the show notes. And Jen, thank you so much. And the Fordham University tribute to your dad brought tears to my eyes.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, I really appreciate you reading it. He's an exceptional interdisciplinary man that I hope to emulate.
Thank you.